Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Thursday, May 16th. I'm Lauren Schmidt reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, another life presumed lost to the Trinity River. CAL FIRE crews prepare in Southern Humboldt. And supervisors debate trail agency appointment. Stay tuned, news on those stories and more coming right up. A 23-year-old Arcata resident is missing and presumed to have drowned after being swept away by the swift waters of the Trinity River near Willow Creek. According to the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office, around 6 p.m. Wednesday evening, deputies were dispatched to Kimtu Beach following the report of a possible drowning. Witnesses stated that an adult male was swimming in the Trinity River when he showed signs of distress before disappearing below the surface. Upon the arrival of first responders, another member of the missing man's party was found stranded on a rock, unable to return to shore. Members of the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office Special Services Division responded with a boat to begin an on-water search. Volunteer firefighters with Willow Creek, Hoopa, and Hawkins Bar assisted in rescue efforts. The U.S. Coast Guard also assisted, and upon their helicopter's arrival, rescued the male subject who was stranded on a rock. These agencies continued search efforts into the evening, but were unable to locate the missing man, now identified as 23-year-old Jeshua Wilkinson of Arcata. Jeshua is of Hawaiian descent, 5 feet 9 inches tall, approximately 160 pounds, with short black hair and brown eyes. He was last seen wearing black shorts. The Humboldt County Sheriff's Office and a Highway Patrol helicopter are continuing their search efforts this Thursday evening. Notably, this is the second tragedy on the Trinity River in less than a month's time. On Monday, April 22nd, a 19-year-old Fortuna resident, Joseph Vivieros Dawson, jumped into the Trinity River, attempting to rescue a juvenile female. Vivieros Dawson remains missing and is also presumed to have drowned.
At this point, we're still doing search and rescue attempts, but we have not been able to locate the individual.
That was Hoopa Police Chief Rolando Ramos, who implores the public to use caution when recreating near the Trinity River.
I just want to caution everyone about recreating on the Trinity River here in Hoopa. The water's still very cold and the currents are still strong. While the dams are not releasing as much water, we still have high water levels, and we want to make sure that people understand the dangers, inherent dangers in this river at this point. We ask that they try to not enter the water and wait till later in the summer. By that time, the water levels are lower, it's cleaned itself out, you get fresher water, and it's a much more calmer setting and less dangerous. So midsummer, mid-June forward, usually the best time to come and enjoy our river.
Anyone with information on this case is asked to contact the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office at 707-445-7251. KMA News extends our condolences to the family. At its recent meeting, the Humboldt County Board of Supervisors debated an at-large appointment to a trail agency and noted the retirement of the Benbow Inn's longtime operators. KMUD's Daniel Mintz reports.
Concerns of landowners along the Great Redwood Trail Corridor influenced the Humboldt County Board of Supervisors debate over a trail-related appointment. At their May 7th meeting, supervisors voted to appoint Jeff Hunterlock, a construction labor union representative, to the 9-member Great Redwood Trail Agency. Also up for appointment were two people who have ties to land ownership, Courtney Wyatt, whose family owns the Fort Seward Ranch, and John Anderson, who works for the Humboldt Redwood Company. The supervisors' debate became a question of whether Wyatt and Anderson should be prioritized due to the perception that they would represent property owners. Board Chair Rex Bone said that's what's needed on the trail agency.
The property owners are scared to death, and they've made phone calls and haven't got the answers. I love Jason Lyles, but he says this is the way it's going to be. We've won all our court cases. So, I support the trail, but they don't feel like they're being listened to, even with these wide open doors. So it would be nice if they had somebody, one out of nine, that they could turn to, know their phone number, know their name, and have had conversations with them. And I think that's a big part of it. You're talking at 250, 300, I don't know how long it's going to be, but you're talking a trail that's going to affect them, bisect their properties. And you said it, wildfire is the biggest thing, and that's what's got them scared to death. This goes through some canyons that they never get to. So I think it's short-sighted on us not to give them the representation they deserve.
Supervisor Michelle Bushnell, whose district includes the Eel River Canyon, a major segment of the trail, agreed. She said owners of properties on the trail path have told her that, quote, landowners aren't being heard. Supervisor Steve Madrone is the board's representative to the agency. He said there's genuine commitment to heeding the concerns of landowners.
That's a commitment that Senator McGuire, Jason Lyles, his staffer, and the rest of us as a board have made to these communities, that we recognize there are significant issues with building this trail. And we have to fulfill those promises to those adjacent landowners and make sure that we do have a system that allows us to prevent trespassing dogs affecting livestock or wildfires. So there is strong commitment on all of our board, but in particular on my own, I'm highly committed to that. And Jeff has also been committed to that.
The discussion included conflict of interest concerns related to Wyatt's family ranch and the labor union's political contributions. But those issues were deemed to be insubstantial, and a vote for Hunterlock proceeded. Bone and Bushnell, reluctantly, joined a unanimous vote to appoint him. Also at the meeting, the board approved a resolution honoring John and Teresa Porter, who are retiring after decades of being leaders of the county's hospitality industry, tourism advocates, and community contributors. The Porters are fixtures in Southern Humboldt for their longtime operation of the Benbow Inn. Bushnell and Bone talked about the Porters' active community participation.
I just want to recognize that last Wednesday night there was a retirement party for John and Teresa Porter, who have been involved in the hospitality profession for 5 decades. It was a very great gathering at the Benbow Inn, and we just really wish them a very happy retirement. And they've been instrumental in Humboldt County in their efforts with not just hospitality, but travel and tourism. And so our board just wishes them congratulations.
Yeah, I went to school with Teresa, and I met John, I think, in the early 70s. When he was running Eureka Inn with the great Christmas tree thing and all that. And I bet in the last 40 years, I have auctioned no less than 300 nights at the Eureka, or at the Bimbo Inn and Eureka Inn over the years that he has donated. So his part in the community has been huge, both in the philanthropic community and in the hospitality.
In addition to operating the inn, the Porters have done key volunteer work for a variety of community organizations. The resolution says that, quote, Teresa and John actively raised over $1.5 million for Humboldt County nonprofits, schools, and individuals in need of medical care. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
The Southern Humboldt Family Resource Center is partnering with the Humboldt County Suicide Prevention Network to assemble We Care boxes. These packages act as a support kit for families grieving the loss of a loved one, and they invite members of the public to join in on this effort. Amy Taronis, the coordinator at the Southern Humboldt Family Resource Center, shares more details.
The Suicide Prevention Network, they do a gift box for folks who have experienced somebody who has committed suicide, either their loved one or a family member, community member, friend. And it's just a gift box that has several different items in it. That just shows people that they care, that they're loved, little reminders that there's people out there thinking of them.
On Friday, May 17th, from 4 to 7 p.m., volunteers will be assembling these care packages for community members who have been impacted by suicide.
We're going to be assembling those boxes. And so the Suicide Prevention Network will be bringing down some items. The Family Resource Center, we've bought and purchased some items locally to put in those boxes as well. And so we're just going to be assembling about 50 boxes on Friday night. We'll have some food and refreshments here, from 4 to 7 on Friday at the Family Resource Center.
Once assembled, these boxes will be available at the Family Resource Center in Redway.
Anybody in our community who has experienced the loss of a loved one, or if they know somebody who has, they can come and get a box to send or to give to those folks. There's no, you know, real criteria that people have to meet, and we just invite anybody to come and get one of those boxes when needed.
Sharing her final thoughts, Tarona says in a small community, the loss of a friend or loved one to suicide is widely felt. And she reminds individuals that they are not alone in their grief.
In a small community that's really interconnected like we are, everybody feels the loss when we have a suicide in our community. And it's not like in a big community or a big city where, you know, they don't get reported so people don't know about it. Everybody knows about it. Everybody talks about it. And oftentimes we don't get the closure that we do because of the shame and the guilt and the lack of, you know, communal grief. I think sometimes we feel powerless as to what to do for folks. Grief is an experience that we're all going to have in one shape or form. And when we grieve the loss of somebody, oftentimes it's publicly, it's communal. But when we deal with suicide, it can be kind of the opposite of that, where there's oftentimes stigma or shame and guilt around suicide. And oftentimes the memorials or celebrations of life feel different. And we want to really reduce that stigma, and we want to offer ways in which we can celebrate people's lives regardless of how, you know, they passed. And I think that this idea that the Suicide Prevention Network came up with was just a great way to remind folks, like I say, that they are loved, that they're thought about. And oftentimes we feel really alone after the loss of a loved one or a friend. And the other part to that, too, is if we have lost somebody, sometimes it's really difficult to find the words to show that you're supporting them or that you care. And you know, with our current culture, it's really easy to send a text message, but making a phone call is really, you know, obsolete, you might say. And so it's really hard to reach out for those of us who want to support others. And so this box idea is kind of cool. You know, they don't even have to purchase it themselves, so it's free to them. And we just kind of put things in the box that we love, and we just have faith that the universe is going to put what that person needs in there. We can just send a text, hey, I put something on your porch, check it out. Or, you know, maybe we take it to them on their first day back to work or something. Just, you know, kind of informal and quiet, but powerful. And sometimes it's just that little reach out and that bridge that we can get.
You can join Taronis and the Humboldt County Suicide Prevention Network at the Family Resource Center in Redway from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, May 17th, to assemble We Care boxes for those mourning the loss of a loved one. Learn more by following the Family Resource Center on social media. The CAL FIRE Redwood Coast Fire Preparedness Exercise have come to a close amidst major shifts in crew demographics. Serenity Wood reports.
On Wednesday, May 15th, six North Coast CAL FIRE crews gathered in Southern Humboldt as part of the three-day annual Redwood Coast Fire Preparedness Exercises. The event was hosted by Incident Commander Marty Hobbs.
My name is Marty Hobbs. I'm the Division Chief out at Eel River Conservation Camp. I'm also the Incident Commander of the Redwood Coast Fire Preparedness Exercise. So the goal of this exercise is we brought around all the different types of crews, fire crews from Mendocino County and Humboldt del Norte counties. And we bring them together. We run them through a set of events and run through a standardization of exercises to make sure that they are ready for this upcoming fire season.
Hand crews must pass multiple tough exercises to be fireline eligible, including finishing a 3.5-mile uphill hike wearing 40-pound average weight web gear within about 65 minutes. This test simulates reality, since locally many roads are too steep for crew buses and firefighters must hike. Here's CAL FIRE Battalion Chief of Prevention, Jeremy Ward.
If we get a big lightning series that comes through, you know, they may be doing a lot more hiking. In some of those cases, we may try to get helicopter crews out there. Sometimes we can get helicopters in. They can hike to a spot that they can then open up and get crews in to land a little bit closer to the fire. The heli-tac crews, the guys who are on the helicopter and land, they do a lot of hiking to fires. Because a lot of times there's not somewhere necessarily real close that they can land.
They also do what's called a tool out, where they recite their fire orders and fire watch out situations, or 10 and 18s. Crews are also graded on a point system for their timed line cut. Here's Incident Commander Marty Hobbs.
The basic standard is to cut 300 feet with a 6-foot saw cut and then a 4-foot scrape to bare mineral soil. We want a 20 feet per crew member. So if we have a crew that has only 12 people, then we times 12 by 20, and then that is our standard. The initial goal is we are shooting for 300 feet in 1 hour. And then, like I said, then we have to change it depending on the change of fuel conditions and how many crew members are on each crew.
According to CAL FIRE official Jeremy Ward, the Redwood Coast fire preparedness exercises are partly a response to a shift in the types of crews fighting fires in the state. Ward noted this situation is due to a lack of availability of inmate workers. According to a 2022 article in the Smithsonian, the numbers of available California inmate firefighters have been reduced drastically by Governor Newsom's measures to reduce the prison population, such as the early release of nonviolent offenders when COVID-19 hit. The transition in terminology from camp to center reflects a shift from unpaid inmate laborers who are confined to the camp to more living wage paid career firefighters who utilize the center as a resource.
So with the lack of ability to find additional inmate firefighters, those numbers have decreased significantly over the last several years. We've had to modify our hand crew program, and by doing so, we've added different types of crews. We have here today a seasonal firefighter crew. That crew is made up of seasonal firefighters just like we would see on one of our fire engines, and they are supervised by an engineer and a captain. We also have worked in conjunction with the California Conservation Corps, the CCC, and we have provided fire captains and engineers to supervise those CCC crews to, again, help bolster our hand crew numbers. And then finally, we've also been working with the California Military Department and cooperating with them, again, to provide additional hand crews that we can use in California to fight these wildfires. So with the change in some of our camps, switching from correctional type camps to seasonal firefighter staff, we've changed the name from it being a fire camp or a conservation camp. Those are now called fire centers.
This year, the Redwood Coast Fire Preparedness Exercises provided the opportunity for 19 fire crews from Humboldt, Del Norte, and Mendocino counties to be evaluated on their physical conditioning, fire safety knowledge, and personal protective equipment. The event also provided crucial personnel for operating under the use of the Incident Command System. CAL FIRE has chief officers that oversee the exercises at both regional and statewide levels. Chief officers come all the way from Sacramento to support these crews. As Chris Curtis, the unit forester for the Humboldt unit, explained, even ex-fire captains attend and participate in this annual series of exercises.
This is a team-building challenge for the fire crews, and the ex-fire crew captains, who are now executive staff, our battalion chiefs, they are continuing to meet this challenge. They hike up the hill, see if they can still do it. So they're all coming up at some point, and we'll see them.
Was that like two of the guys we passed, and you asked if they wanted a ride, and they said no?
That's yeah. Exactly why.
For KMUD, I'm Serenity Wood.
Turning to Mendocino, KMUD's Matt LaFever brings the latest from Mendocino County. where landlines are more secure from a recent court ruling. A nearly 50-year Jane Doe was identified, and a county government merger has caused controversy.
This is Matt LaFever with the headlines out of Mendocino County for Thursday, May 16th, 2024. Last year, Mendocino County pushed back against AT&T's bid to abandon its role as the carrier of last resort for land service in rural areas. Their move raised concerns about the future of reliable communication in Mendocino County and other rural parts of the state. However, Judge Thomas Glagola's recent recommendations to dismiss AT&T's application has brought relief to many worried residents in Ukiah and beyond. Public outcry ensued after AT&T notified customers, including those in Mendocino County, of its intent to withdraw from rural landline services. Thousands of comments flooded in, emphasizing the necessity of landlines due to unreliable cell phones and internet coverage in areas throughout Northern California. Regina Costa of TURN, the Utility Reform Network, criticized AT&T's motives, arguing that the company's claims of promoting broadband access were unsubstantiated. She emphasized that AT&T's proposal lacked a clear plan for alternative service provision in Mendocino County and other rural areas. The administrative law judge handling the case questioned AT&T's assertions, pointing out that the company's arguments about regulatory constraints were inaccurate. Judge Glagola's recommendation underscored the necessity of ensuring an adequate replacement carrier before relieving AT&T of its responsibilities in Mendocino County and across California. Despite this setback, AT&T remains determined to secure relief from its carrier of last resort obligations. Regina Costa urged the public, especially in Mendocino County, to continue advocating against AT&T's efforts, emphasizing the importance of ongoing pressure to preserve essential telecommunications services in rural California. Now let's turn to a decades-old mystery in the area of Highway 175 between Lake and Mendocino counties, which has seen a breakthrough. On September 18, 1979, a couple hunting in the remote area stumbled upon skeletal remains. Deputy Powers from the Lake County Sheriff's Office responded and initiated a homicide investigation. Sadly, the case grew cold, and the skeleton remained unidentified for decades. Over the years, the Lake County Sheriff's Office has pursued leads with the California Department of Justice, leveraging emerging technology to identify the unknown victim. In March of 2023, a breakthrough occurred when a representative of the California Department of Justice suggested using Othram, a private DNA lab known for cutting-edge procedures. By January 2024, a potential match for a living relative had surfaced, leading to critical information about the victim's family. Then, in March of 2024, a second match provided more details. A living relative mentioned a missing grandmother's sister from the 1970s. Armed with new information, a sergeant with the Lake County Sheriff's Office conducted interviews and additional DNA testing. It was in April 2024 the mystery had been solved. Jane Doe was identified as Wanda Lee Brewer from Carson, California. This breakthrough has reignited the investigation. Although this case is old, detectives are hoping for new leads. Anyone with information is urged to contact Sergeant Mora of the Lake County Sheriff's Office at jeffrey.mora@lakecountyca.gov. We now turn to a recent Board of Supervisors meeting where a decision to merge key health departments sparked debate among county supervisors. Last week, a proposal to combine the Public Health and Behavioral Health and Recovery Services departments into a new entity called Health Services faced scrutiny from county supervisors. Dr. Janine Miller, currently the head of Behavioral Health, would lead this new entity, aiming to streamline operations and save Mendocino County an estimated $200,000. Second District Supervisor Maureen Mulheron highlighted the cost-saving potential and emphasized the ongoing efforts to articulate the new structure. However, concerns from other supervisors, like 5th District Supervisor Ted Williams and 1st District Supervisor Glenn McGordy, centered on the need for a comprehensive plan before formal approval. Supervisor Williams stressed the importance of a fully fleshed-out vision, citing past missteps such as the unpopular relocation of the Veterans Services Office. He expressed a desire for clarity on the long-term vision and organizational impact of this merger. In a surprising turn of events, the matter was actually revisited towards the end of the meeting as a senior department staff member presented a letter endorsing Dr. Miller's leadership, signed by employees. However, union representative Patrick Hickey raised concerns about potential coercion in obtaining these signatures for the letter. And that's the latest from Mendocino County. I'm Matt LaFever in Hopland, reporting for KMUD News.
In international news, Gazan refugee camp residents endure hardships. KPFA's Rami Amuleri reports from Gaza.
The extended family of Abdel Fattah al-Sharafi is sitting up a tent in the Maghaza refugee camp. They just arrived here after fleeing Rafah. It's their second displacement since the October 7th Hamas attack and Israel's ensuing war in Gaza. The family was first displaced from northern Gaza. Abdel Fattah al-Sharafi is a 65-year-old grandfather. He told Pacifica that the family does not know where to go.
We arrived here today after they dropped leaflets telling us to leave Rafah for Deir al-Balah or to Mawasi areas 4 or 5 days ago. We didn't find any spaces available there, so we came here to Maghazi. We went to my son's place near Al-Aqsa Hospital in Deir al-Balah, but there was no room because my son and 50 other people live in just one tent.
Abdel Fattah's family is now seeking safety within an UNRWA, United Nations Relief Agency-run school for girls. Widad is Abdel Fattah's wife.
There is no safety at all. Even when I am sleeping, I do not feel safe. Before we left Rafah, we witnessed shelling and bombardments around, and this had terribly disturbed us and our children.
But UNRWA no longer staffs the school after Israeli forces invaded the Maghazi refugee camp. The UN has not returned to the facility, abandoning it. The school is now being used as a shelter for dozens of displaced families, including Abdel Fattah's daughter-in-law and her family. Zuzu al-Sharafi is among the displaced residents now sheltering at the school. She's from the Jabalia refugee camp.
This school where we've been taking shelter has not been recognized by UNRWA since the last invasion, when Israeli forces shelled the school and invaded it. Why should we go to other recognized schools when all schools are crowded and have no room for us? We demand UNRWA recognize us and supply power and water at least.
Since Israel began the ground invasion in the southern city of Rafah, thousands of Palestinian families have sought safe shelter in the middle area. Many displaced families from Rafah have erected their own tents on privately owned farmlands in the middle area of Gaza Strip. The majority of displaced families are people from northern Gaza and Gaza City. For Pacifica Radio, KPFA, I am Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, and thanks to our reporters, Serenity Wood, Daniel Mintz, Matt LaFever, and Rami Al-Mighari. Reporting from our studio in Redway, I'm Lauren Schmidt.